If you've been lucky enough to study religions, as I have, one of the things that is bound to really be of interest to you is how religions change. It's kind of a revelation to a lot of people that religions do change. Because religions change, you may have noted, at a more or less geological or evolutionary time frame. I mean, it's just not like every... It's why I think it's so amazing to people, this new pope we have, because, well, we have, they have. Feels like we have, doesn't it? Because he's just everywhere. It's just everywhere. But, you know, because the Catholic Church had been so absolutely not going to change in any slight regard for so long, if anything was going to change, it was going to go back to the way things were before. The last two popes in particular, and then so, wow, all of a sudden. But ordinarily, that's not what happens. Ordinarily, it's incredibly slow change, and it just is fascinating to see how it does, in fact, change. And then some of the changes themselves are just so intrinsically interesting. Let us say you had a religion that did not conceive of an afterlife. It's this life and that's it. We die and that's it. That was the religion of Judaism for a very long time until, we're not exactly sure, but certainly within the century before Jesus came along, a group called the Pharisees introduced some really big changes. The Pharisees were a learned intellectual elite. They were not based in the temple. They were based out of the countryside. They were much beloved by the people. They were an extremely important force. And they promulgated a new teaching. Which was, we know this sort of direct quoting exact way from Josephus, who wrote about them. He pointed out that they believed in what he described in their belief as an imperishable soul. A soul in each of us that is in some way imperishable. So that was itself quite an innovation for a religion that had not had this. This innovation was tragically opposed by another group called the Sadducees. These were the very, very, very harshly conservative priest associated group that had sort of associated with the temple in Jerusalem. They were not highly regarded, but they were powerful. They were against this stuff. But the Pharisees not only added the idea that we as individuals have imperishable souls, they stipulated two possible outcomes for those souls. One, for the people who are in some way good in this meant that you have followed the law and the prophets. Those who are good in some way would wind up undergoing at death a change in their body such that they would be in heaven and would have thereafter what they would essentially call a heavenly body. People who had not, the wicked, as they would have said, did not undergo this change in body, kept the same body, but in a way, that was how they became subject to eternal torment in hell. Well, this is a lot of innovation really fast. So, what would have prompted this? And imagine how this started. This wasn't like some sort of universal idea in the world that just their group didn't have. Imagine that someday some Pharisee or someone who taught Pharisee would just this idea occurred. And not only the idea of the immortality of the soul, but this whole bifurcated idea about the future beyond death and the post-mortem rewards of good and bad. And that's quite a thing. How did this come about? Well, it came about. We don't know exactly how it came about, but we know that they began to teach it, and it was because they did that we can have this parable from Jesus. Because if Jesus had given this parable in a context that had not been prepared for by the Pharisees teaching on these subjects and teaching essentially these exact things on this subject, Jesus would not have made sense. Well, he said it wouldn't have made sense to anyone. But it did, and in fact, we know that his teaching in this parable was really an exact statement of what had come about among really not everyone, but a really significant majority of the people of his religion at the time, particularly out in the hinterlands. This is what they believed. And this morning, we're going to set aside the heaven part, because we're going to talk about the hell. Because that's really the focus, isn't it? I mean, we are given to see Lazarus in the bosom of Abraham, but really this is about the rich man and how he wound up. And what the auditors of this parable, as Jesus was telling it, would have thought about this teaching in a moment, how they would have seen it. Would they have approved? Would they have disapproved? Would this have made sense to them? Yes, it would exactly have made sense to them. So why would you, if you were a religion and you had no sense of the afterlife, but you were willing to go along with the idea of there being a heaven if we were good, but you were also willing to risk such an awful outcome? I mean, what if God judges the other way on any of us and we wound up in the... Why would they be willing to risk that? Well, it seems that. You know, they didn't look at this the way we do. They didn't look at that image of the rich man down in Hades in torment. They didn't look at that and see it the way we did. They looked at that and they saw, well, you were warned. You knew the rules. This makes sense to them. You knew the rules. Lots of traditional societies around the world today, if you look at them, they have what we consider draconian, barbaric kinds of punishments for minor crimes. And yes, why does this make sense? Why do they not oppose this? Why are they not outraged as we are? They say, well, they knew the rules. The rules are the rules. They knew the fair penalty for this was serious. All they had to do was read Moses and the prophets. This made sense to all of the Christian faith for more or less 1700, 1800 years. In our country, it was the late 18th century. We're talking quite a while later. The late 18th century, under the influence of the Scottish Enlightenment, that a bunch of, by the way, congregational pastors in Boston, led by one in particular named Charles Chauncey, the most influential man in late 18th century Boston, pastor, said, no, I don't think we're going any further with that. His congregation gave him a couple of years off to study the Bible. He had a couple of years of leave to study the Bible, to write about this subject. He later wrote a book called Benevolence of the Deity, which is probably one of the most important books ever written in American history. But there was a sort of a pre-version of it that came out surreptitiously. It was called Chauncey's Pudding. Chauncey's Pudding. It was a shortened version of this that was circulated secretly among the congregational clergy of Boston and the Boston area. And what it finally was addressing was Jesus himself. Because this wasn't just the teaching of hell and the idea that a loving God would somehow cast people into an eternal torment without any relief, without any redemption at any point. It wasn't just addressing this. It was addressing the fact that Jesus himself taught this, believed this. And so, they were very interested in reading Chauncey's Pudding. They would gather at gatherings and they would say, have you tasted Chauncey's Pudding? But they were afraid of it. They were afraid of it. Why were they afraid of it? Well, because one of the reasons that a religion would take on such
such a doctrine, such a thought, that it has practical consequences, it has practical value, it has practical purposes. There are three usually cited. And the ministers in Boston had all three in mind. One of them was that they seem to provide disincentives. The idea if there is this vicious, awful fate out there awaiting you if you disobey the commandments of God, that you might begin torment for it, that would be a real disincentive. That would be a deterrent to wrongdoing. And second, they often thought it would provide, people have often thought this would provide some sort of sense of justice. If you are one of the oppressed, if you are one of the people who has been done wrong, who has been hurt, who has been injured, who has been the victim of some terrible crime. I'm sorry, do we have a...
Okay,
I just can't see. All right, thank you. If you are a victim, if you are someone who has suffered a great deal of your family and life through a war or some kind of terrible thing, this kind of doctrine that there is a terrible, terrible punishment for those who have hurt you and your family so much, this is, we have felt, people have believed, some sort of sense of deserve, what philosophers call just deserts. That we will see in this, that we will feel approbation, is the word they use, approval, moral approval for this kind of punishment, even as severe as this. The third notion, by the way, that one just simply dodges the question of whether any such torment could ever be considered just. But the third, descriptions of eternal torment in hell seem maybe to function as safeguards against violence. In terrible political situations where great numbers of oppressed, the question was, could we manage to forestall peasant revolts or the slaves revolting by simply intimidating them with the thought that if they did that, they would spend eternity in hell because they would be cut loose from the church? And so they thought, look, okay, we cannot square the idea of a loving God with the idea of God casting people into hell for all of eternity, into the most horrible, exquisite pain and suffering for all eternity. We cannot square that. But we're afraid to say so. We are afraid to say so. And it was the mid-19th century. It was the mid-19th century, quite a while later, before our tradition overall began to say, no, you know what? Even if Jesus believed in it, we cannot square a loving God with such a notion. And for the most part, the last 100, 120 years, that has been our view. Here's my view growing up. I grew up in a evangelical context. Out west, we weren't fundamentalists, but we believed in the Bible and so forth. But from the very earliest days of my life, I just never believed in this. Especially since it came to the point that you didn't have to be just such a terrible person. All you had to do was just not have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, and God was going to send you this. Never bought that. So I'm not here to tell you this morning what you need to believe. What I am here to talk about is how difficult this is, and I'm going to throw a real fly in the ointment about this now. Because it's very, if I may say so, easy for us. Very easy for us to look at this thing and say, you know, we just can't go with that. But let's take ourselves outside of our situation and let us imagine that we are a working class woman, a diner waitress who lives in a trailer park in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, or Chickasha, Oklahoma. Where I grew up. And let us imagine that our husband, the person whom we were married, is a really drinks a lot, you know. Drinks a lot, gambles. But does go to church with her on Sunday at the Free Will Baptist Church down the street. She's already been hit a few times. She's already been hit a few times, but she does not feel that she can leave. And she believes in her heart, in part because she needs to, but also because she just does believe that his being in presence in that church on Sunday morning and hearing the threat of the fear of God, if she believes, and if it is at all possibly true, that this threat of the fear of God is in fact some mitigation of her danger. If a doctrine of hell and eternal punishment is a kind of divine restraining order, one that actually may work, I don't know. We going to be telling this person there's no hell? We going to be blowing that away for her? I don't think so. I don't think so. And there are a lot of vulnerable people out there. Vulnerable people who are never going to get justice in any way in this life. And if they believe that in whatever measure those that are injuring them, hurting them, destroying their lives and their families are in any way restrained by the idea that God may punish them, maybe that's okay. Maybe that's okay. It doesn't mean we have to believe it. But it means the truth is situational, isn't it? It's very situational. Thomas Paine said that belief in a cruel God makes a cruel man. That's the other part of the system. It's just so easy to believe that that pastor down the street who is at once assuring her that God will punish her husband if he does terrible things to her is also happy with a lot of things we would consider cruel. So it is not just that there is, in Christian teaching historically, this enormous judgment call on the part of God about all of our lives. It is that when we come to things like this, we are dealing with something that is so multivalent, that is so explosive, that is so powerful in so many people's lives, that our talking about this, whatever we personally believe, whatever we believe as a tradition, what we say about this is a giant judgment call. We need to be as conscious as we can possibly be about the dimensions of that judgment call in our time and place. Next week's sermon will be called The Bosom of Abraham. It will be about heaven. And I don't promise great sermons, that is for you to judge. But I do promise great subject matter. And next Sunday is going to be a great Sunday.